Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of CRECA, the Center for Russian History in Central Asia, I'm pleased to welcome you to the second in our fall lecture series. My name is Jennifer Tischler. I'm the Associate Director of CRECA, filling in for Ted Gerber, who's in Washington, D.C. today. Anyhow, we have a sign-up sheet that's going around. I do ask you to give us your name. It helps with the catering paperwork. If you're not yet on the CRECA mailing list and would like to get lots of emails from us about upcoming events and funding opportunities, please give us your email contact information. And we do have, we meet regularly here on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Next week's talk is on the topic of stealing socialism, economic crime and punishment in the Khrushchev period by James Heinzen of Rowan University. And we have copies of that flyer in the back of the room, as well as our at-a-glance poster for the rest of the semester. But you will always find more information on other events on our website. Okay, so that takes care of the housekeeping. We're delighted to have as our speaker this week one of our PhD alumni, Victoria Thorstensen, Vika, who got her PhD in Slavic Languages and Literature in 2013, and since 2014 has been an assistant professor of Russian literature in the Department of World Languages and Literatures at Nazarbayev University in Astana, Kazakhstan. Vika's research interests include Russian 19th century polemical novels, realism, Dostoevsky, Lyskov, and translation theory and practice. And as you can see, her talk today will be on the nihilist fashion, the aesthetic relations of blue spectacles to reality. So let's give Vika a warm Wisconsin welcome home.
Thank you, everyone. It's a joy to be here. And I think only for David Bethay, it might be an old material. So I was afraid there will be more people familiar with my dissertation, because this is a part of it that I have recently reworked and submitted as an article. I also spent the good part of the day browsing internet for images, so that I'm really glad that the projector works, and I'm hoping to rely on images rather than on my text. So, and since I did not really time where the images should come in, my trick would be to go to the next one. So it's there, okay? So I'll do that right away. Okay. I guess I'll just explain to ease you into it. So this first image is an illustration to Fathers and Sons from the satirical newspaper The Spark, Iskra, that depicts Bazarov there in the corner and Madame Odintsova smoking. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the critics of Bazarov's way of dressing in particular, Nikolai Chernyshevsky dressed very neatly. This is his photograph from the 1850s. Okay. So I am going to speak about the 1860s, the nihilist epoch, which was plagued by fascinating inconsistencies and interesting mismatches between art and reality, between, as again, David Bethay and I know, between scientific knowledge in the original and its unpopularized summaries, between self-perceptions and perceptions of self by others, as evident, for example, in the diaries of Chernyshevsky and Dobrolyubov, and the way they were perceived and idealized by their followers. Those mismatches could be discerned everywhere, from the philosophical maxims of the nihilists to their dress, which is the subject of today's talk. So today's talk is really about fashion, a new sphere for me. So Nikolai Chernyshevsky's notorious master's thesis, The Aesthetic Relations of Art to Reality, and his novel, What is to be Done, were at the start of this episteme. not only serving as a sort of aesthetic pleasure, the novel is credited with having provided codes of behavior that were realized in the lives of the novel's young readers. Today's talk is based, as I said, on a section of my dissertation that I have recently reworked into an article to be published in Clothing Cultures. So I will explore one of the epoch's mismatches, a gap between, on the one hand, the stereotypical visual image of the real-life nihilist, that one, that is, nihilist in his stereotypical dress and hairstyle, so on, and on the other hand, the visual image of the nihilist in the fiction and life of the ideologues of the movement, such as Chernyshevsky. So firstly, by using letters, memoirs, personal accounts, and visual arts, I will explore the nihilist code of dress in real life. Okay. I will show that the rigid code of the nihilist dress and the mode of its signification proves it to be an amalgam of various codes connected to earlier protest movements, one out of which it organically grew. And secondly, I will demonstrate that a completely different code of dress, followed by Chernyshevsky in his life and fiction, completely overlooked the real-life nihilist fashion. I will then suggest that the discussion of fashion sheds an interesting light on the divergence between the literary types of the new man and the nihilist in the polemical fiction of the 1860s. Speaking metaphorically, I suggest that that divergence is partly a result of Chernyshevsky's, well, not to Chernyshevsky's, many Chernyshevsky's, not looking at reality through the blue spectacles, as he reflected that reality and reworked it aesthetically in his writing. So, about the nihilist epoch and its variant codes of signification. So, often referred to as the new man, following Chernyshevsky's usage in What Is to Be Done, the stereotypical image of the real-life nihilist, as it got reflected in literature, in journalistic polemic, in personal accounts, in art, was indeed an amalgam of rigid system of beliefs and of no less rigid codes of behavior and dress. The nihilist costume, as it existed, signified the general spirit of the transfiguration of all life, when, as one memorist recalls, everything that had existed traditionally and had formally been accepted without criticism came up for rearrangement. Everything, beginning with theoretical peaks, religious views, the basis of the state, and the organization of society, all the way to quotidian customs, to clothing, and to hairstyles. This was the time. A part of that general transfiguration of life, Russian nihilism is best understood as a sociocultural movement, or a type of youth counterculture. And it is, as it is common for such movements, philosophical tenets of nihilism were no more important than the visual modes of signification of one's belonging to the movement, to that host of the elect. Claudia Verhoeven, the writer, the author of the book about Karakozov, Old Man Karakozov, thus summarizes various descriptions of the nihilist costume of those elect. So this is what they looked like, and I will come back to this quote in its original form, so this is in a shorter summary. So, simple dress, long hair for young men and short for young women, informal address, brisk manners, dirty fingernails, and walking sticks, sometimes wide-brimmed, flattened, black, Fra Diavolo hats, it comes from an opera, so it's associated with a particular character, or otherwise Polish caps and dark blue tinted glasses. Okay, so this is what they actually looked like, right? I'm emphasizing it because I can't show you the pictures of what they look like. So, I have on with that. Although nihilist counterculture seems to have been recognizable and cohesive, it was just as plagued with fascinating mismatches as everything else in the 1860s. Already the duplicity of the terms nihilist versus new man is emblematic. Thus, in discussions of the literature of the period, the common approach is to refer to nihilists when their depictions come from the movement's critics, And to Newman, when it's when referring to the so-called democratic literature like Chernyshevsky's novel. However, the issue of the nihilist fashion undermines this seemingly plausible distinction based strictly on ideology. Moreover, an analysis of the nihilist dress reveals a striking mismatch in that dichotomy, one that problematizes also the commonplace notion of the literature-centric nature of the 1860s as the time of universal life creation, or the special relations between art and reality in the nihilist milieu. The reality does not seem to correspond to art and suggests a different dichotomy. Two different codes of dress coexisted among the members of the movement. I argue that these codes differentiated not between a positive and a negative attitude toward nihilism, but between the ideologues of the new movement, of the new man nihilists, and their followers. This distinction being based not on ideology, but rather often on social class. Thus, numerous photographs and portraits of the ideologues of the nihilist democratic movement, from radical journalists to the leaders of terrorist organizations, depict people dressed in conventional mainstream clothing. Such are also the descriptions of clothing in most democratic novels written by them, and which often means in their auto-portrayals. So let me just show you some pictures. So what these people were like. And so here is Chernyshevsky and Dobrolyubov, two twin brothers, because they're looking the same. And they're nice three-piece suits with bow ties. And the glasses that they're wearing are not blue. Right? In fact, at the end of the 1850s, as we know, just the nihilism was sort of picking up and becoming this mass fandom. Chernyshevsky bought a pair of glasses in gold frame, so nice, very nice glasses. So I'll show you some more of these people. So these are the people from the circle of Chernyshevsky, who were also connected to the revolutionary movement, so to say. So this Sirakovsky, that looks like a tsarist general, but in fact is one of the revolutionaries, but look at the way he looked. And the other officers, right? So Shulgunov here, actually, as many people say, he was the prototype of Vera Pavlovna's husband or the second husband, not sure exactly which, but this is where this whole love triangle played out in reality. But of course, he also did not look like a typical, stereotypical nihilist. And here are some more. So the second member of that same triangle, Mikhail, who was living with Shulgunov's wife, again looking very neatly dressed. Right? Sierna Solovyovich, you know, who wrote the proclamations asking Petersburg and Russia to be burned and everyone to be, millions of people to be killed. You know, those famous proclamations he printed out with Herzen's help and that was spread around. And this is Ultima, another member of that revolutionary circle. Okay, so. On the other hand, the stereotypical nihilist dress, the portrayals of which are found in satirical journalism, in so-called anti-nihilist novels as descriptions, and in memoirs accounts also as descriptions. You know, it's very hard to actually find photographs. People didn't do them, maybe because they were so much on the fringes of society. The stereotypical nihilist dress seemingly appeared in Russia quite suddenly in the beginning of the nihilist epoch and quickly became a mass phenomenon in the widest circles of the movement's rank and file's followers. I argue that the code of the stereotypical nihilist dress grew organically and independently of nihilist ideologies. Moreover, its development was connected to earlier codes of protest movement and fashion and received its nihilist signification only through secondary associations with nihilist ideologies. While Chernyshevsky elaborated the ideological and behavioral codes of nihilism in his writings, he overlooked the existing nihilist code of dress. and thus commonly associated with nihilism, the nihilist code of dress was not vehemently defended by radical journalists as they had defended their other ideas, as they defended their theoretical and behavioral codes. And as a result, although the mass following in the nihilist counterculture made the nihilist dress recognizable and stereotypical, such ubiquitousness also opened it to criticism in the absence of its defenders and made the superficiality in the adoption of both dress and ideas a widespread phenomenon. So let's go to the roots of the nihilist fashion, which, as I said, continues the protest against mainstream fashion and, in particular, against traditional gender roles. The nonconformist youth of the 1860s, the nihilists, established a counterculture in which the protest against mainstream society was expressed not only through beliefs and values, but also through manners and appearance. In spite of the nihilist mantra that, quote, real beauty is in delivering men from hunger, the question of clothing was for them of paramount importance. The nihilist fashion style came into existence independently of the literary works that defined the period. Although the influence of some literary works on the fashion style and the other way around existed was rather complicated, and you know, if you ask me about it, I can say a few words, but so coming back. I argue that it continued, the nihilist fashion continued the tradition of protest against the dominant social ideologies and had roots in the dress styles of earlier European protest movements. As their earlier predecessors, the nihilists inscribed their mostly deeply held convictions and ideas onto their bodies through their dress. Thus, the nihilist fashion exemplified not a break, but a continuation in the long-standing protest against traditional gender roles. In Herzen's apt summary, and here's my bad French, sans crinoline advanced to replace sans culotte. Okay? So, as Verhoeven observes, progressive gender relations and definitions were also obvious from the exchange of hair length standards about men and women. While the nihilist fashion was a next step in the tradition of fashion protests, the militant break with the past that it represented caused a shock in Russia, which was strongly felt by contemporaries. That shock was partly a result of the panic associated with the 1862 fires in St. Petersburg and political proclamations that were spread around that time, flooded the city around that time. And public associated the threat of violence with the nihilist dress, and that was seen as a symbol of it. So the gossip was that the nihilists were the one who set the city on fire. And Nikolai Leskov was blamed for a lot of it because in his reporting in the Northern Bee, he said, well, is this gossip true or not? Please tell us because we are all in panic. So from 1862 till 1866, in those 4 years, the nihilist dress was more and more associated with violence. And although the students, as you know, were required to wear a student's uniform, what people were afraid was not the student's uniform, but that particular nihilist dress, as I will give you some examples later. So the high stakes of wearing the nihilist dress. The political persecution of nihilist girls. We'll start with the girls, they suffered more. So, and as I said, it's very hard to find anything actually depicting what those nihilists look like. We have a lot of descriptions, in words, but images do not really exist or hard to find. So here I'll just show you Vera Zasulich, because here you see her dressed relatively modestly, probably in something that a nihilist girl would wear, and of course, short hair, which is for girls harder to get rid of, right? It's easy to cut hair when it's long, and of course if it's short, you stop with it. So that's why she is depicted with it. And this is Apollinaria Suslova in her nihilist period. So she also, well, of course she never really dressed completely like an Eilish show, it's played with it, but here you can see a little bit of that. Julie Buckler calls Russian nihilist girls fashion guerrillas who rejected the enslaving frills and charms of conventional femininity and used their bodies as the new site of signification for their political ideas, often placing themselves in physically dangerous situations to write vengeance on the bodies of their aristocratic oppressors. And she's talking about later nihilist girls, the ones who went into the terrorist movements like Vera Zasulich. I'm not sure what my next one is. Okay. So here we have some caricatures. Those are from 1911, but they sort of preserve the stereotype that started then, and then, of course, continues as revolutionary movement did as we know. And here is actually the 1860s drawing, and you can also see girls short hair. Generally, among the reasons that ushered in the nihilist fashion style, the contemporaries named a desire not to resemble the contemptible Philistines in anything and to openly showcase one's belonging to the host of the elect. However, for many of the nihilist girls, wearing the nihilist dress went beyond a simple protest against gender roles and an act of belonging, and indeed became a political act. The persecution of young nihilist girls, many of whom belonged actually to high society, for what they perceived to be strict simplicity of their dress, was compared to that of tens and thousands of Russian men when Peter the Great cut their beards, mustaches, and long hair. And this sort of description comes from the 60s. It's from Stasov's recollections about his sister. And in reality, in the 1860s, 70s, there were instances, some of them comical, of police persecution simply for wearing clothes associated with nihilist fashion. In the late 1860s, a special government commission was created in response to a report of an arrest in the city of Feodosia of a young woman who was accused of free thinking. The arrest was made because of her way of dressing. Consequently, the commission proposed to prohibit nihilists from, quote, wearing external markers and emblems of their doctrines, such as, quote, long hair and blue spectacles, and to arrest the transgressors. Although no such regulation was adopted, the case of the Feodosian woman did not remain a single occurrence. A similar event is related by Nikitenko in his diary. In March 1872, he wrote that the school teacher Latysheva had been arrested on the street and brought to the police for questioning because she was wearing blue spectacles and sported cropped hair. It turned out that the young lady belonged, in fact, to a good family. Her father was a counselor of state. She had to cut her hair after a long illness, as she explained, and wore dark spectacles because of the weakness of her eyes. Mm-hmm. Not until a visit to Trepov of the city governor was paid by the enraged parents, and questioning that demonstrated an absence of nihilist beliefs completed, was the young lady released and allowed to go home, apparently. Characteristically, the reported cases of the police persecution of girls dressed in nihilist clothing occurred in the late 1860s. As the political epoch of the 1860s, it can be seen to have ended with Karakozov's shot, and here I'm going to Claudia Verhoeven's argument about that. She also considers the end point of the mass fascination with nihilist fashion to have occurred in connection with April 4, 1866. To those young people whose nihilism was primarily a matter of fashion, the real political violence and the subsequent government crackdown on political dissent was a powerful antidote. Herzen's relation of hearsay in an 1867 article in which he characterized Karakozov's shot as an administrative godsend that showed Alexander II that allowed Alexander II to crack down on all those spectacles and shockheads by issuing Senate and Synod order, according to which within 24 hours the girls were to grow their cropped hair, to remove their spectacles, and to give a written undertaking to have sound eyes and wear crinolines. As a result, as Verhoeven observes, one secret agent reported to his superiors,
that the nihilist who had still been a recognizable regular and therefore regulated or at least regulatable part of urban fauna became barely noticeable in the capital. So this is of course partly a joke. It's just funny, but so from 1862 to 1866, the fashion was consistently more and more associated with violence, and then it subsided, or at least among the more superficial followers. So, let's talk about Vera Paulovna's sewing cooperative and Olga Sakratovna's crinolines now. So, seemingly this strong connection between political protest and fashion had existed among the ideological tenets of the nihilist movement. The nihilist Bible, Chernyshevsky's novel What is to be Done, can be seen, among other things, as a practical manual of how to found and manage a fashion business. Its heroine, Vera Paulovna, illustrates how Chernyshevsky's ideology can be brought to life in the form of a sewing cooperative. The economic success of the cooperative in the novel is a result of a business strategy and a marketing plan that involves opening offices on the city's fashionable streets and expanding a clientele base into high society. To put Chernyshevsky's, in this case, quite blurred vision of the role of fashion in political protest movements in context, and to appreciate the true scope of the transformation and shock that the real-life nihilist fashion brought to Russia, we need to look at mainstream fashion. Overall, to state that the simple dress of the nihilist girls displayed, here quote, her repudiation of the ribbons, ruffles, feathers, parasols, hoops, and crinolines of the world of the pampered, helpless young ladies of high styles and fashion, unquote, understates the scope of her protest. In women's fashion, the middle of the 19th century, depicted here, was a period of the dome-shaped skirt. Full skirts that had made their appearance in the 1840s continuously grew in volume. The 1850s saw the introduction of crinolines, that is, of horsehair used as stiffening fabric in the outermost of multiple petticoats. By the 1860s, skirts swelled out to the maximum capacity which materials, flounces, understiffening, and multiple petticoats can produce. And I'm quoting for various fashion books. A revolution in fashion came in 1856, when the so-called artificial crinoline, which is concentric whalebone wire and watch spring hoops suspended on strips of material with or without covering fabric, was invented. So this allowed women to get rid of the multiple petticoats, reduce the weight of the skirt, and completely transform its contour and outline and the nature of its movement. So some comical instances you probably heard about with, you know, those things overturn and it's hard to maneuver. The fullness of the skirt reached the maximum that any woman could wear decently and comfortably in the 1860s. And thereafter, this skirt fullness started to diminish in various ways until the skirt became a figure-hugging hubble in the period of the 1870s, 80s. And you remember what Anna Karenina looks like. Okay. So it went big in the 60s when we discuss it, and then went up. So in other words, the most stunning thing about the protest against crinolines in nihilist girls' fashion is that it did not come at the time when they were, when the women were tired of crinolines, but precisely at the time when they were the most excited about them, in the very years when crinolines were introduced. Public outrage against nihilist fashion should be measured against the women's excitement about mainstream fashion. And in this context, Vera Paulovna's business in What is to be Done acquires a particular significance. So her sewing cooperative reflects a fascination with the world of new fashion and the crinolines, which undoubtedly was shared by her prototype, Chernyshevsky's wife, Olga Sakratovna Chernyshevskaya. Oriented to the gain of maximum profit, Vera Paulovna and her staff, comprised of former prostitutes and seamstresses from lower classes, could not and did not produce simple, unadorned dresses for young nihilist women. So Chernyshevsky's vision of the radiant future was based on his new woman, Vera Polina, who sewed fashionable dresses for high society women, while the real-life nihilist girls actively protested against that mainstream fashion and even faced political persecution. Chernyshevsky's blindness to the existing nihilist fashion and the nihilist girls' plight when he based his future communist utopia on Olga Sakratovna's crinolines is just as baffling as the fact that Vera Polina's cooperative did indeed become a model and an icon of the nihilist generation. Overall, it appears that those mismatches were not exceptions, but rather the rules and operational principles within the nihilist movement. So let's talk about men. So men's fashion, their origins of the nihilist protest. As with women's nihilist fashion, the scope of the nihilist men's protest needs to be measured against the mainstream fashion. So the world of men's mainstream fashion, with its obligatory waistcoats, frock coats, high-starched collars and cravats, dark top hats and gloves, also saw somewhat a revolution in the 60s when the three-piece suit was introduced for the first time. The true extent of the generational gap between fathers and sons and the degree to which a nihilist in his clothing differed from the father's will be evident if we consider the description of the fashion-conscious Turgenev in the time of his youth. Okay. So he is a younger, some other Panaev. I don't remember who recalls. I remember, as it were today, that I saw Turgenev for the first time at Ivan Ivanovich's at Panaev's. He had come from paying visits to members of high society and was dressed in a blue tailcoat with golden buttons depicting lion heads, light checkered knickers, a white vest, and a bright tie. Such was the fashion at that time. And as you've seen, probably remember Turgenev's portraits, he has always been extremely fashion conscious, and that probably explains why in Fathers and Sons, Bazarov actually wears some remnants of the nihilist costume that we remember from those stereotypical descriptions. He wears balakhon, right? So none of Chernyshevsky's heroes wear balakhons, and that was part of the reason why that Bazarov looked like he did on the caricature that I showed. So not sure how much time I have. So the young men of the nihilist generation strove to attain a very different look. The nihilist anti-fashion existed, according to the memorist and literary historian Skabichevsky, throughout the 60s and 70s, constituting a demonstrative visual protest against the Philistine morals of the rest of the society, and inscribing that protest on the bodies of the nihilist, it consisted of the following items: plaids and gnarled clubs, shoulder-length manes, blue spectacles, hats a la Fra Diavolo, and confederatka hats. What a poetic halo did all this have in those times, and how it made all the young hearts beat. It should be taken into account that all this was worn not only because of rational considerations and not out of a desire to simplify oneself, but demonstratively in order to showcase one's belonging, again, to the host of the elect. As research into the origin of various items of the nihilist dress shows, the nihilist fashion developed among university students, those in particular who were studying at European universities, especially in Germany. I argue that every element of the nihilist costume can be traced back to a Western European original. The nihilist fashion, which became a universally recognizable marker of the Russian nihilist, just like most of the ideological tenets, is in fact imported. Thus, we know that long hair for men had been traditionally associated with free thinking and nonconformism. It became one of the markers of the nihilist image, appearing in life first before it made its way into fiction. The long hair in the 1860s represented a development in the traditional image of a free thinker. It looked different from that of a preceding generation of students in that it was less frequently combed and washed. And that change received an ideological justification. reflecting a shift of priorities in the light of the ideology of the nihilist generation. As they would have said, their serious study of sciences did not leave time for such trifles as combing. So, another woman of the 60s, memoirist Elizaveta Vodovozova, tells about her well-meaning relatives who cautioned her, a young institutka, not to let herself get seduced by young men who walk around with their hair uncombed, lahmati. As a well-meaning relative lamented, quote, "Nowadays, the young men are ceasing to wash themselves, comb and dress properly, and all this in order to get more time for the study of sciences." Quote. So other elements of the nihilist costume inscribed more protest ideologies onto the bodies of their wearers. Thus, the nihilist hats that I already mentioned several times. So here we have the hair. And it's interesting that those caricatures reflect the stereotypes, right? So we see them there, the uncombed hair, and the balakon of Bazarov, and that is Odintsova. And you know, everyone recognizes this image because it became so much associated with probably the most famous nihilist, Rodion Raskolnikov. It's always on the cover, right, of Crime and Punishment. Okay, so. Those, for example, Fra Diavolo and especially Polish Konfederatka hats are another Western European import. Okay, I'll show you. Associated with the spirit of revolt. So Fra Diavolo, a popular Italian guerrilla leader and fighter against the Napoleonic invasion of the Kingdom of Naples, was a character in numerous works of fiction and a famous opera. Which premiered in St. Petersburg in 31, so it's quite old. And after that became a permanent part of the theatrical repertoire in Russia. Hats a la Fra Diavolo were big, round, and wide-brimmed. The Konfederatka hats here, also known as Rogatyvkas, are four-cornered Polish hats. They became popular in Russia as early as the end of the 18th century as an informal hat among the officers. After Kosciuszko's insurrection, they spread in revolutionary France and throughout Europe. In the 20s, 40s, Konfederatka hats started to be worn by liberal university youth at European universities, as in the following image, and it's likely that Russian youth of the 60s adopted them back via Germany. So, another item of the nihilist clothing, the famous pleds, pledi. Betray a long history and a connection to Western European protest tradition. So pledi appeared as a fashionable item in Europe and in Russia at the beginning of the 19th century. Their popularity was in some part due to the success of historical novels of Sir Walter Scott, who romanticized Scottish national dress, and Pushkin on a famous portrait is wearing one. Pleds were worn as outwear in place of traditional coats, and again, in the 40s, the use of pleds underwent a revival in Russia on the wave of Anglomania, and later, the Russian nihilists took those pleds as a desired addition to their dress. Adopting the pled, the nihilists reframed the romantic protest into their own. Presumably being easy to wear and care for, their pleds made their look appear more hygienic, as they said, and informal. Two of the most sympathetic representations of Russian students of the period, Yaroshenko, on Yaroshenko's paintings, the student and girl student, Kursistka, portray a young man and woman wearing pleds and attest to the fact that pleds were typical for both genders. So in their hats and pleds, the nihilists kept an aura of free thinking and romanticism that transcended time. And even if you read today's descriptions of this to paintings and art books, they discern the look of the student as Napoleonic and romantic, and they speak about the girl looking sort of transcending gender barriers and looked more like a person than just a man or a woman. And we'll also talk a little bit about the spectacle. So in comparison with other accessories that made one look like a nihilist, tinted blue spectacles are perhaps the most universal recognizable unisex attributes of the nihilist fashion. their color being the most remarkable feature, one that is seemingly imbued with symbolism. Thus, thirsting for such symbolism, Claudia Verhoeven exclaims, only why, this remains forever mysterious, does the world of the nihilists look blue? The blue spectacles of the nihilists appear to be brimming with symbolism. However, the history proves that all symbolic readings, no matter what kind of perceptive and biting critique of the movement they suggest, they remain afterthoughts. The reality is that there was perhaps an equal possibility of the world of the nihilists, that the world of the nihilists could look pink. The way those spectacles were sold is that the color did not actually matter and was not perceived to be anything special. So the optometrists had those big boxes of spectacles. They would, you say you need one, they put and you choose one. So there were blue, there were green, there were yellow, and so on. So the world of the nihilist could have looked pink. But the reality is that there was the reality is that, of course, it did not look pink. It looked blue. So it's interesting. Wearing blue spectacles in public became fashionable among Russian students around the 1860s. Their color blue did not seem as odd as it does nowadays. After all, modern glasses, as I said, that were invented in 1752 by James Esco, did not favor clear lenses because they were not good for eyes. So the spectacles were invented, it was desirable that the lens is tinted. So, and before blue spectacles become associated with nihilism, they appear in literature in quite neutral context as common reading glasses. So, for example, in Alexander Herzen's 1846 short story, Mimoyezdom, In Passing, an assistant to the chairman of the, in the criminal chamber in a provincial Russian town, characterized as a most honest man and a big eccentric, wears blue spectacles, a detail which in the story signifies nothing more than the fact that this man is a learned man. So there are many more examples that I found before the 1860s where characters wear blue glasses and there is no significant symbolic significance attached to it. By the mid-1860s, blue spectacles become a stereotypical part of the nihilist portrayals in literature and in journalism. Quite often, they appear on the noses of those characters for whom nihilism is firstly a matter of appearance and only then ideology. But that is also connected to the fact that Chernyshevsky and the defenders of the movement did not, as I said, portray nihilists in their dress, only the people who were criticizing them, or the people who were more observant and fashion conscious, like Turgenev. Of course, Bazarov does not wear, but he could have worn spectacles if Turgenev wanted, because he wears a ball of horn. So, quickly in literature and in those caricatures, blue glasses become the stereotypical image of the nihilist and is connected to the ideas not being authentic. Okay. So, for example, the leader of the nihilist commune in Vsevolod Krestovsky's novel Panurgovo Stado, Panurge's Herd, Ardalion Palayarov, is vain, and above all things he cares about his appearance. Palayarov is described as a tall man in blue spectacles and in an intentionally crumbled felt hat from under which long, thick, curly, and uncombed hair was falling on his shoulders in disarray. By covering the eyes, blue spectacles can draw attention to the other parts of the face that appears in case with Levi Afanov, a former seminarian and teacher and title character in Vladislav Markevich's novel Marina from Ali Rok. Levi Afanov wears blue spectacles in a metal frame that hide his eyes and make his interlocutors concentrate on his thin and long lips that always form a sarcastic and unpleasant grin. So in Leskov's 1970 novella Zagadochny Chelovek, Mysterious Man, Nechiparenko, a dull-witted, sickly, puny, and disgustingly untidy person, in the homegrown parody of a true revolutionary, also wears blue spectacles to attain a serious look. So that also is true for the descriptions of women. For example, in Nadinka Lipetskaya, the female heroine of Viktor Avinarius's novel Povetria, The Plague, 1867, starts wearing spectacles when she joins nihilist circles. Blue spectacles unfortunately hide her expressive dark blue eyes, and overall she is portrayed as naturally lively and feminine in spite of her spectacles. Trying to skip some here and get to some conclusion. So in the context of Russian nihilist movement, however, unseen and untheorized in democratic literature and journalism, blue spectacles were picked up in the writing of nihilist critics, where they revealed or acquired their symbolic potential. In all the above descriptions of nihilists, blue spectacles have a symbolic meaning. They hide the eyes of the nihilist men and women and therefore suggest an idea of duplicity, deception, fraud. They are also a powerful symbol of the specifically nihilist type of distorted worldview. The nihilist creed of negation could be symbolically interpreted as a consequence of looking at the world through dark glasses. It might seem also that the blue spectacles became an accessory to the nihilist costume due to the association with disdain for society and intellectualism, as a symbol that they could imply that a bespectacled nihilist could see what the unenlightened other could not. All this is very good. However, in reality, blue spectacles first became a part of the nihilist fashion and only later received their symbolic meaning in the writing of the nihilism's critics. Okay. So how much more do you want to visit? I found this. Okay. I don't know. Maybe you can just ask me questions. I have a few more pages of the same stuff, but I think I didn't time myself properly. So it's. I think the idea is quite there. So I'll let you ask me for conclusions, maybe, or some other. I'll see if I have more pages too. So here I have the portrait of Vera Zasulic, and so this is something that has been discussed in some recent books on Vera Zasulic and on Thea and on terrorism. So Vera Zasulic designed her costume and specifically for this terrorist act with an understanding that she will be photographed. So there is a sort of intention there. And she, before that, when she was younger and she just joined the nihilist circles, she took considerable effort in looking like a nihilist. That included ordering particular boots that were looking ugly, but of course cost quite a lot of money. So to look like a nihilist required attention to detail. It was, you needed to find the places to procure all the accessories, all the items, and it was not, so easy. As you probably know, to look like, what would be the counter fashion now, to look like a hipster, you have to try. You can't just, not comb your hair and appear to be a nihilist. And this also is a story. What actually this talks about is that those nihilists were often young men and women who belonged to high society, had means, and were viewing this as an interesting sort of counterculture. Whereas Chernyshevsky had different aspirations, and the people like him. So they wanted to enter high society by dressing nice and by not dressing like a nihilist. So there's an interesting problem there. Thank you.
Just very nice lecture and your dissertation. I'm just thinking that Have you tried to apply the key theory for a nation of author from protagonist to explain why Chernyshevsky, not just from social position, was not there in Michael's clothes, but because he was dissociating himself from the subject as an intellectual, not as much as a person who liked to change something inside. And you showed Clinton, she had glasses, but she had a clean hair, yes, but can you look from the position of philosophy of authorities, looking at a person in wearing so-called inappropriate clothes, mm-hmm. yes, from like the point of view of security, which comes first, mm-hmm. yes, like traditions, preservation, and I don't think they change too much now. From Tsarskaya Ohranka, for instance, mm-hmm. yes, to FSB, who will be stopping somebody in burqa and thinking that this person is causing or at least like posing a threat to mm-hmm. Russian society. So one is like typically a hysterical thing when vneположnost автора героя, yes, for his theory. Mm-hmm. And the second is mm-hmm. is a philosophical standing of a security guy who determines how a person should be looked like from the position of mm-hmm. preservation. Of
yeah. Uh-huh. Thank you. Thank you very much. No, I did not use Bakhtin. You know, in my thinking about Chernyshevsky, I'm all, you know, what strikes me as more interesting is the degree to which he actually inscribes himself into his characters, and I'm not sure about alienation. Of course, this is the subject of this, right, the talk, because it's about the aesthetic relations of art and reality, so I can look more into it and see what other interesting things that come out. In terms of the power, yes, indeed, and I have, you know, sections that are about the spies of the Third Department trying to look like the nihilists so they can arrest them. And it's interesting that most of those descriptions do come from the police reports. They come from, you know, discuss those police cases of persecution. So, of course, people who dress like this, you know, this is what it is. It's a counterculture, and people going, you know, challenging society, going to the fringes of society. And of course, there is just one step to, you know, terrorism, and, you know, there is things that become the problem of the police. But it's, yeah, it's there. You know, so I'm not sure. I think I'm talking about it, but of course, it can be done more. Thank you.
Question. I'm just interested in the production side of the blue spectacles. I mean, you talk about the fact that the symbolism comes later. Mm-hmm. So what was the motivation for creating them to begin with? They seem, from someone who does wear glasses, uh-huh. now I'm nearsighted and farsighted all at the same time, uh-huh. it seems really impractical. Unless you're reading in bright sunlight or something.
Right.
Like that. So why create them?
No, this is
how
this
glass was produced, or
right. So this is exactly that interesting history of them, that they were invented not as with transparent lenses, but it was a part of the science that went into spectacles, into glasses, that they need to protect. Once you put the lenses on your eyes, the sun mm-hmm. gets really into them, so you need the tint.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. One of my ideas was to try to locate all those, you know, advertisements, maybe for optometrists, mm-hmm. and you know, but I couldn't, you know, didn't have the time for that, and I don't know if it can be found. You know, where exactly did they go and find those classes? But I'm guessing they were available commercially, and it's just a matter of digging deeper into the box and finding the ones that you wanted.
To follow up, I had exactly the same question as Jennifer, and wanted to, with the same eye problems, and wanted to follow up thinking about how impractical. I can understand that in France.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand sitting reading by a window in bright sunshine that had tinting. I mean, I need to wear sunglasses a lot, I get that. In Petersburg, it seemed extraordinarily impractical. So I don't understand if it's reflected indeed in literature prior to the 1860s. Mm-hmm. Was this literature
yes,
in St. Petersburg? How were the settings described? Under what settings would people be mm-hmm. using darkened tinted glasses in St. Petersburg literature?
Not Petersburg, it doesn't matter.
I don't know about St. Petersburg literature. For example, I know that Shevchenko ordered a pair of blue spectacles in the late 50s, and I don't think, although he was sort of friendly with the group, I don't think of him as particularly a nihilist, so that probably was not really connected. And maybe he took them to the sunny Ukraine, I don't know, maybe blue spectacles were not popular in St. Petersburg and were on sale. So those things combined, I don't know.
Or were they, I'm just intrigued by your discussion of their being described in literature or appearing
yes,
in texts
yes.
prior to the 1860s.
Yes,
so
mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in whether there were any shifts. Was that in what literature was that? In what settings was that? Did they therefore become marked in St. Petersburg because it seems mm-hmm. singularly impractical there? Or as you say, did it just happen to be one manufacturer who had that
uh-huh.
around? It would be interesting to look at the production side and the text side at the same
right.
time.
So of course it would have been great if all writers just described everything that their characters were wearing, but of course they pick some details here and there.
Right.
So blue spectacles before, you know, that this nihilist craze were described as set by Herzen
uh-huh.
without any connection to any free thinking.
Uh-huh.
So just by government clerk, there was something in Turgenev, there was something in something else. Somewhere else, I think, so, but without much significance.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the 60s, when they quickly become in life associated with the nihilist movement, they immediately go into their literature and become the stereotype nihilist description. But it's interesting that in European fiction,
mm-hmm.
later on, blue spectacles also appear sometimes in, you know, the image of the Russian nihilist did become stereotypical in the West as well, but there are those things in Western literature that you wonder are whether they are associated or not. I'll give you one example here. Mm-hmm. Okay, as Oscar Wilde says in An Ideal Husband, quote, "Optimism begins in a broad grin, and pessimism ends with blue spectacles."
Mm-hmm.
So it's a sort of, they do mm-hmm. have this signification
mm-hmm.
in them that becomes sort of revealed,
mm-hmm.
Even independent of the nihilist movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. So in of course in Herbert Wells, the invisible man wears blue spectacles. So he wore blue spectacles with side lights, you know, the lights here as well, so that you could not actually think that he has eyes when indeed he didn't. Right. So, and in O. Henry's short story, Conscience in Art, 1917, there are blue spectacles also. when someone wants to pass for someone else, as sort of masking one's appearance.
So Pico, I was sort of to understand what you were suggesting. So the blue spectacles at first, when they're described in literature
mm-hmm.
or journalism, it's basically a caricature of the nihilist. But that when a real nihilist like Chernyshevsky or Dobrolyubov, who were dressed properly. In the pictures, they were attempting themselves to be kind of more neutral, The idea of that they were trying to kind of penetrate or raise themselves up into high society, I'm not sure that sounds so convincing to me, but the fact that the whole thing about the blue spectacles being a kind of being like you say counterculture, a kind of exaggerated affectation of some of the young people, but the chairmanship to W was those guys didn't go in for that. So that was was that something created by, more conservative writers to make fun of the nihilists, or was that something that, because Kukshina in Turgenev is a complete caricature. I mean, so. So,
but she does not belong to that type. She is, an earlier.
She's a Korsistochka or something. Yeah. Well, she's too older for that. But anyway, I just want to. I'm trying to get a sense from what you're saying of what the actual nihilists were. They dressing this way, or was it a kind of, affectation that those that were making fun of them were just talking about a lot. Mm-hmm.
So I think that the movement dependent, as I said, and grew out of sort of earlier protest movements and became a part of that development of the counter fashion as it develops according to its own laws, and then the also there was this spirit about the change and the nihilist ideologies those appearing in Savremennik and so on, and they took them on, those young people. So the people who we think are the ideologues of the movement, like Chernyshevsky, he could see where the society was going with ideas, with behavior also, but somehow he was completely oblivious to where the dress went, where the clothes went. So he did not depict that, he did not discuss that, they did not. And the people who they depict as young, as new men, they look completely conventional. They don't look like any, like the real people who were in the street, young people in Moscow and Petersburg were. So, and what happened is that this the actual reality got into newspapers, got into the way people talk, got into the police reports and activity, but. And later they were reflected by people who wrote about the movement, but not from the point of view of Chernyshevsky. So that it made into this anti-nihilist literature.
Okay, so that was later, like Krestovsky.
Yeah. So, but not it was everything was quick. It was all about mid 60s. It happened in the 60s, and Chernyshevsky and Dobrolyubov and Slivtsov, other people who wrote. From the same sort of Savremennik circle, they did not reflect that reality, and therefore made it possible for people to criticize them, the way nihilists looked, and through the way they looked, to criticize the ideas and the followers. So what I'm saying is the split between new men and the nihilists as two literary types is partly based on Chernyshevsky and the Savremennik people sort of ignoring the way they looked like, because if they defended that they made up this nihilist code of dress, a part of this whole nihilist ideology, maybe things would have turned out differently.
Interesting. Because Oliver Sakharov and Chernyshevsky W, they're all dressed sort of, at least what we see from the pictures, and their early pictures, but they're all very, it's all very dark, there's nothing flashy about it at all.
Well, no, they did not dress in nihilist clothes. They did not wear blue spectacles.
Just one short comment. Mm-hmm. I really like to make it. It was really interesting that you mentioned that Shevchenko wore their blue glasses because his attitude to color blue is really negative. Because he wrote a lot of stories depicting blue blood. Yes. And blue in Ukrainian, plakitny. Yes. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, or like he was enticing people, what would have happened if we can really hard hit a novel? Is a blue blood will come out? And that kind of going through
for his like poetry, so he doesn't like this color at all.
Maybe because he had to wear those glasses every day. But they weren't cheap, you know, once you wear the glasses, you're sort of stuck with them for 2 years.
That's for sure.
Any last questions or comments for you?
Hi, thank you very much for this fascinating lecture. I don't have any question. I think I am the only one out of this group because I'm not familiar with the topics. I read Russian literature for fun only. However, your lecture or maybe your article is excellent. You wandered a dangerous territory. You can be labeled as a as an essentialist, but you you left that territory very successfully. I like how you built your article, your lecture, between new and tradition versus modern and ideology, how ideology used dress codes, and also university students, young generation, adopted police persecution. So that was a very rich lecture. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, interesting. Thank you, welcome. And I hope you keep reading Russian literature.
Okay, well, thank you, Vika.